15. Standing alone in the woods, Parsons thought, I am the man they are searching for, 35 years. The people at the lodge would kill him at once as soon as Corith indicted him. They would show no mercy. And why should they? Had he himself? Perhaps he could break the sequence at some point, catch myself before I come back here, he thought, before I kill him the first time. Above his head, a metallic object moved swiftly, leaving the woods and going to the cliff. The object dropped beyond the edge of the cliff. He heard its jets roaring as it stabilized itself near Corith. The old woman and her daughter had gone to collect the dying man. In the vicinity, he realized, there were three other time ships. Four, if Stenog's was included. This one had already gone into motion, but the others remained. Or did they? I have to get to one of them, he thought. He began running aimlessly in panic, but the ships from past time segments, he could not approach them without disrupting history. That left only Stenog's ship, and the one that he had arrived here in. Could he go back and face Loris and the others, knowing that he had killed Corith? He had to. Coming out on the cliff, he began running back the way he had originally come. As far as they're concerned, he told himself, this trip has simply been a failure. As before, no one has been able to make out what happened. I've given them no help. My plan was a failure. There is no choice but to give up and return to the future. While he ran, he saw over the cliff the tiny figures on the beach below. Stenog's men at the boat. The men, with their oars, were tracing huge letters in the sand. Parsons paused and saw that the letters spelled out his name. Stenog was trying to signal him. With great speed, as if by some prearranged system, the men got their message completed as he stood gazing down. Parsons, they saw, no, warning him that this time the trip had not been a total failure. So he could not go back after all. Turning, he sprinted across the open space, back into the woods. Once they see me, he realized, they'll kill me. Or, his heart sank. They don't even have to do that. All they have to do is go back to the future without me. Leave me here. But then I can go down to Stenog's ship, he realized. Go down and find himself in the hands of the government once more, to be shipped out to the prison colonies. Was that what he wanted? Was that better than remaining here a castaway? At least he would be free here. He could certainly contact an Indian tribe in the area, survive with them. And later on, when a ship from Europe arrived, he could go back with them. He racked his brains. What was the next contact between this region, Nova Albion, and the old world? Something like 1595. A captain named Cermeno had would wreck his vessel off the entrance to the Estero. That was 16 years. 16 years here, living on clams and deer, squatting around a fire, huddled in a tent made of animal hide, scratching at the soil for roots. This was the superlative culture that Corith wanted to preserve in place of Elizabethan England. Better, Parsons thought, to turn myself over to Stenog. He started back in the direction of the cliff. Ahead of him, a figure emerged, stepping into his path. For one terrible instant, he thought it was Corith. The powerful shoulders, the grim, rigid features, the sharp, hawk-like nose. It was Helmar, Corith's son. Halting, Parsons faced him. Now Loris and Jephthy appeared. By the expression on their faces, he saw that Stenog had not lied to him. He was on his way down to them, Helmar said to Loris. Loris, her face stark, said, You betrayed us. No, Parsons said. But he knew that it was pointless to try to talk to them. When did the idea come to you? Loris said. Back at the lodge? Did you get us to bring you here so you could do it? Or did the idea come to you when you saw him? Parsons said. The idea never came to me. You intercepted him, Loris said. You went down and talked to Drake. You conferred with him. We saw you. And then you came up the cliff and stopped Korath and murdered him. And then you were going back down to Drake to go back with him. He warned you that we saw. He had his men right in the sand, so you knew you couldn't go back to us. To that, Parsons said nothing. He faced them silently. Pointing his weapon at Parsons, Helmar said, "We're going back to the time ship." "Why?" Parsons said. "Why not kill me here?" he wondered.
"Nixina has made the decision," Loras said.
"What decision?"
Loras, in a choked, constricted voice, said,
"She thinks you didn't mean to do it. She says,"
she broke off,
"if you had meant to do it, you would have brought some kind of weapon with you. She thinks you stopped Korath to argue with him, and that he wouldn't listen to you, and you fought each other, and in the fight Korath was stabbed."
Parsons said, "I warned him not to go down."
They were listening, at least for a moment.
"I told him," he said, "that it's not Drake down there, it's Stenog waiting for him."
After a pause, Loras said,
"And of course my father had never heard of Stenog. He didn't know what you meant."
Bitterly, her lips twisting, she said,
"And he saw the white showing on your arm. He knew you were a white man, and he didn't trust you. He wouldn't listen to you, and it cost him his life."
"Yes," Parsons said.
All of them were silent now.
"He was too suspicious," Loras said at last. "Unwilling to trust anyone. Nixina was right. You didn't mean to. It wasn't your fault, any more than it was his."
She raised her dark, grief-stricken eyes.
"It was his fault, in a sense, for being the way he was." "There's no use thinking about that now,"
Jephthy said curtly.
"No,"
Loras agreed.
"Well, there's nothing to do but go back. We failed."
Helmar said, "At least we know how it happened." He eyed Parsons with scorn and loathing.
"We'll abide by Nixina's decision,"
Jephthy said to him in a sharp, commanding voice.
"Yes," Helmar said, still staring fixedly at Parsons.
"What is her decision?"
Parsons demanded. Loras said,
"We'll..."
She hesitated.
"Even if it was an accident,"
she said woodenly,
"we feel that you should make some sort of atonement for it. We're going to leave you here, but not at this point in time."
Her voice grew fainter.
"A little further along."
With comprehension, Parsons said, "You mean after Drake's ship has left?" Helmar said, "You can spend your time trying to find that out." With his weapon, he indicated that he wanted Parsons to come toward them. Together they walked back along the cliff, to the time ship. Sitting in front of the ship, in her special chair, Nixina waited for them unseeingly. Several of the wolf tribe stood around her. When they reached her, Parsons stopped.
"I'm sorry," he said.
The old woman's head moved slightly, but she said nothing.
"Your son wouldn't listen to me," Parsons said.
After a time, Nixina said,
"You shouldn't have stopped him. You weren't worthy to stop him."
Parsons thought, "The blame has to be on me. For them to admit that Korath was responsible through his fanaticism and paranoia, that would be too much for them. Psychologically, they could not stand it." So, he thought, "I'm the scapegoat. I must be punished as proof of my guilt." Wordlessly, he entered the ship.
Trees. He stood looking around him, trying to catch some indication of change. Blue sky, the distant boom of the surf. All the same, except.
As fast as possible, he made his way to the cliff. Below, the beach, sand, seaweed, the Pacific. Nothing else. The careenage had ended. The Golden Hind had gone. Or had not yet come. How could he tell? Marks in the sand? The remains of the wooden stakes to which the ropes had been tied? Some debris of some sort would remain. But what did it matter? Maybe, he thought,
I can find some way of getting south down into Mexico. Cortez, when he landed, the best I can hope for is to reach a friendly Indian tribe. If I'm lucky, I can either live with them or persuade them to help me get south. But I can't remember if there are Spanish settlements yet, and I don't know what year this is. So even if I remembered, it would not help me. They could have moved me back a century, or even several centuries. Ocean, rocks, trees, those remain the same for 1,000 years. I may be standing here 200 years before the first white man lands in the New World, he thought. In fact, I may be the first white man in the New World. At least, he could go down to the beach and see. If there were any debris left from the Golden Hind, it would prove that they had not moved him back in time, and that would be something. A faint hope, the Spanish colonies to the south, and then a ship back to Europe. Once again, he began the slow, dangerous descent to the beach. For an hour, he searched up and down the beach, seeing no sign of the ship or the men ever having been there. No marks, no refuse. What about the brass plate? He asked himself, where had Drake actually left it? Lying in the sand? Buried in the face of the cliff? He searched for that. But by now, he had covered so much of the beach that he no longer had a central point from which to work. Possibly, he had wandered a mile or so from his original spot. The beach all looked alike now, cliff and sand and seaweed. Suddenly, he stopped in his tracks. If he was stranded here, how did he manage to get back to the Wolf Lodge to kill Corinth a second time? All this had no importance. Obviously, he did get back to the lodge. If not, then he would be removed from this place anyhow by the new time sequence set up by his failure to reach the recuperating Corinth. And the only way he could get back to the Wolf Lodge was by means of a time ship. Obviously, someone came back to get him. Would come back. But how soon? He could spend years here, decades, become an old man, and then, after all that, one of them could return in a time ship and pick him up near the end of his life. For instance, he might, over a period of years, work his way south to a Spanish settlement, and then back to Spain, up to England, where he would manage to make contact with Stenog. Eventually, in that manner, he could regain access to the future, a worn-out, fever-ravaged old man whose life was over, a man who had wandered the face of the globe, who had used up his life. And of course, it was always possible that someone else killed Corinth the second time. He noticed now that the day was ending. The air had become cold and the sun had moved to the edge of the sky. A few gulls flapped by overhead. Their mournful cry, like the rubbing of ropes, made the scene even more lonely. Night would come on soon. What would he do? He couldn't spend the night on the beach. Better to trudge back up and start inland, back across the peninsula. As he recalled, there had been Indian settlements on the inner bay, Tamales Bay, where it was more sheltered. Standing on the beach, looking up at the cliff, he did not see a way to ascend. He would have to go along the beach, searching for one of the declivities, or a spot where trees and shrubs had grown. But he was too tired. I'll have to wait until tomorrow, he decided. He seated himself on a log that had been washed up on the beach, unlaced his moccasins, and rested his head on his arms. Closing his eyes, he listened to the surf and the croaking gulls. The inhuman, inhospitable sound. How many millions of years, more or less, had this sound gone on? Long before there had been any men, and long after. He thought, it would be so easy to walk out into the water and not come back. Simply start walking. The chill wind blew about him. He shivered. How long could he sit here? Not much longer. Opening his eyes, he saw that it had become appreciably darker. The sun had now disappeared. Far off, a flight of birds disappeared beyond the hills to the north. Like children, he thought, punishing me by exiling me here, unable to bear the blame themselves. And yet, in a sense, they were right. I should bear the blame. I was the agent responsible for his death,
and if I had a chance to kill him again, I would. I wish to God I had that chance, he thought. He got up from the log and began walking along aimlessly, kicking at shells on the sand ahead of him. A large rock crashed noisily down the cliffside. Involuntarily, he jumped away. The rock rolled out onto the beach, along with a shower of smaller stones. Shading his eyes, he peered up. A figure stood at the top of the cliff, waving to him. The figure cupped its hands to its mouth and called something, but the boom of the surf blotted it out. He saw only the outline of the figure. He could not tell if it was a man or a woman or what it wore. At once he began frantically waving back. Help! He shouted. He ran toward the cliff, indicating that he could not climb up. Now he scampered along, half falling, trying to find a way up. Above him, the figure made motions that he could not grasp. He halted, panting for breath, trying to make out what it was telling him. Then the figure abruptly disappeared. One moment it was there, the next it was gone. He blinked in bewilderment, feeling slow terror creep over him. The person had turned away from the cliff and gone off. Frozen with disbelief, he remained where he was, unable to stir. And while he stood there, a metallic sphere rose from the top of the cliff and rapidly floated down to the beach. The time ship landed on the sand ahead of him. Who would come out? He waited, his heart laboring. The door opened and Loris appeared. She did not wear the Indian costume now. She had changed back to the gray robe of the wolves. Her face had lost most of its shock and grief. He realized that for her, considerable time had passed. Hello, doctor, she said. He could only gaze mutely at her. I came back for you, she said. She added, it's a month or so later. I'm sorry it took so long. How long has it been for you? You haven't got any beard, and your clothes look about the same. I hope it's the same day. Yes, he said, hearing his voice grate out harshly. Come on, she said, beckoning him toward her. Get in. I'll take you back, doctor, to your own time, to your wife. She smiled at him, a forced smile. You don't deserve to be left here, she added. Nobody from your civilization would ever find you here. Helmar saw to that. This is 1597. No one will come here for a long, long time. Trembling, he stepped into the time ship. After she had closed the door behind him, he said, What made you change your mind? Loris said, You'll find out someday. It has to do with something that you and I did together. Something that didn't seem important at the time. Again, she smiled at him, but this time it was an enigmatic, almost caressing smile on her full, dark lips. I appreciate it, he said. Do you want me to take you directly back? She asked, as she began to operate the controls. Was there anything from our period that you need? I have your instrument case here. She pointed, and he saw, on the floor of the time ship, his familiar gray case. With difficulty, he said, I'd like to go back to the lodge for a little while, to get cleaned up, change my clothes, rest. I don't want to return to my family this way. He indicated the ragged fur costume, the remains of the dye. They'll think it's a wild man escaped from the zoo. Of course, Loris said in the formal, civil way that he had become familiar with. The aristocratic politeness. We'll go back to my time. You'll be given whatever you need. Of course, you'll have to stay out of sight. No one else must see you, but you understand that. I'll take you directly to my apartment. Fine, he said. And he thought with a rush of misery, it's her father that I'm going back for. To complete what I have to do. How will she feel if she ever finds out? Maybe she never will. If I can get use of the time machine for even a second. She saved me, he thought, so that I can murder her father for the second time. Silently, he sat watching her manipulate the controls.